nothing left. Ever since I was a child, I had a feeling that something is missing in me. I ought to know why I'm here. Can any of us know that?
Become yourself. Then God and the devil don't mess.
I want to learn. Can you find the force to enable these two quite opposite lines to live together in yourself? At any moment, the wolf can devour the lamb.
And you must learn what it means to become responsible.
This is an exact science. And that is why you are here.
RedIceCreations.com. You can listen to much more radio on interesting and controversial topics, from hidden history and cover-ups to the metaphysical and much more. As you might know, we like to hear different sides of the same story and researchers that have different conclusions to offer, as we try to highlight a broad spectrum of viewpoints that you seldom hear presented elsewhere, so that you can come to your own conclusions and decide for yourself. Today, our program is with A. True Ott. He received his degree in the field of nutrition. He has been counseling and lecturing on prime nutrition for over 15 years and co-founded Mother Earth Minerals in 1997. Ott is the author and publisher of dozens of articles and three books on nutrition. From 1996 to 2001, True co-produced the radio program The Story Behind the Story at KSUB Radio in Cedar City, Utah, and was awarded the Peabody Award for Radio Documentary. In the first hour, we'll discuss his background as a Mormon and his time on Wall Street, where he learned the truth about money, and Ott shares parallels between Mormons, Jews or Khazarians, and Freemasonry. He'll also talk about the political movement Zionism and the goal of world domination. We'll also discuss Red Symphony, the document, and the Frankfurt School. All right, welcome to the program, True Ott. I'm excited to have you with us. First of all, thank you for coming on. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Heinrich. It's totally my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You bet. This is going to be really interesting. We have so many different things we want to talk about, get into, so many important topics, of course. But in the beginning here, I thought we could just talk a little bit about yourself, your background, kind of where you're coming from, I guess, and when you got involved in some of the topics that we're going to discuss here today.
Well, nobody wakes up in the morning and says, I'm going to talk or to be an expert or research a certain topic. You just kind of fall into it, and that's what happened to me, Heinrich, indeed. I grew up a Latter-day Saint Mormon, very much so, very, very active, a fifth-generation Mormon, I got to say that. Here in Utah, I actually grew up in Nevada, the state of Nevada in America. And I grew up in every way a Mormon boy, right? Trained and mind controlled, programmed, if you will, to not question authority. I mean, that's really one of the hallmarks of Mormonism. They're just really trained not to question the people in authority. And I grew up in that culture, grew up in that mindset. And it was just a huge, huge withdrawal. Getting out of that mind-controlled, I call it a cult today. It's a mind-controlled cult, mm-hmm. A mind-bending cult. And I got to tell you, it just didn't happen overnight. It took a series of events. But the bottom line is, you got to either stand for truth, honor, and integrity. I mean, if you uncover a huge lie, I submit you just can't continue to be a part of that. I completely got a clear picture, 100% clear picture of the fraud, the hoax, the lie that is Mormonism. And so I extracted myself. It was not pleasant. It was not easy to do so. But I did.
What happened, if you don't mind me asking? How did you stumble upon the lie, or the truth, rather?
Well, here it really goes back into my financial background. I graduated from the University of Southern Utah in the field of accounting. I had a Bachelor of Arts, actually, BA in accounting. And I call it a gift. I think sometimes it's a curse. My mind is different. My brain is different than a lot of people. I have an ability to do numbers, mathematics. That I excelled in statistics. So I was able to see equations that a lot of people couldn't see. Where I was getting A+, you know, straight A's in statistical courses. Others would, you know, really stumble and hate statistics. And so, make a long story short, I went in after I graduated, went to work for a general authority of the LDS Church and his company, Intermountain Financial Group. The gentleman was Hugh W. Pinnock, who I had met personally while I was on my LDS Church mission at 19 years old. He was attracted to my skill set, asked me to contact him when I got back and graduated from the university, which I did, and he employed me. And as an Intermountain of Financial Group, I became a stockbroker, a financial planner, if you will. I was fully licensed with the SEC to do not only stocks and bonds, but all commodities and derivatives, et cetera, et cetera. Arbitrage, all of that was part of the game. And Mormonism is when it's all said and done, it's really a for-profit mega corporation. Now, I had to understand that because I took an aptitude course and I scored in the 99th percentile, whatever that means. 1% of the people taking the test had financial aptitude. And so they awarded me a 6-week scholarship to Wall Street, to New York City. And basically, I was there with about 24, 25 other 1%ers, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we were basically given the key to the city. For 6 weeks, we were put up in the penthouse suites of the Marquis Marriott Hotel overlooking Broadway. We went behind the scenes of the stock exchange, the NYSE. We actually got to ring the bell, which is kind of cool, opening a session. We did all of this, and we went behind the scenes in the World Trade Center. This is back when the Twin Towers were still standing. Learned all the intricacies of really how the Federal Reserve works. Okay, really, we did. We had no money. We actually sat at the feet of Federal Reserve Chairman Paul Volcker, and had a 45-minute question and answer session with him. Another gentleman was John Volcker, the top executive of Citibank, who just flat out told us the realities of what the money system was. And I'm sitting here as a young, naive Mormon lad, not really understanding that all around me were 23 other Jews. They were Jews. I got to just say what it is.
Sure.
And they used language and terminology that I frankly was not familiar with, since I'm not part of their synagogue. Terms like goy and goyim and other such terms. But I got to tell you, it was stunning, because I left that 6 weeks with a shocking sense of, you know, things are not what they seem to be, completely and totally. Volcker said that there was just a matter of time before the United States dollar would be pulled. There would be no more dollars, per se. There would just be electronic currencies. And he didn't know when that day would be. He says it may not even be in my lifetime. But make no mistake, it will happen, he explained.
So you're saying that obviously that the people who are invited into the club early on are taught the full story. These younglings, if you will, actually get told the full score about the lie of the money system. Isn't that kind of risky, though? Considering, well, you're one who's speaking out about it now, of course, but I'm surprised they would do that.
Well, they do that, but they understand. You have to understand they refer to themselves as the chosen ones. Now, the Mormon church are also an appendage of the chosen ones that come. That's what led me out of the church. You see, I said, wait a minute, chosen ones of who?
Mm.
You see, and that's, this is all a smoke and mirrors hoax, and it's a grand design, Heinrich. And this sounds really far-fetched because of the programming involved in people's minds, but this is a group, a couple, that have no less of a grand desire than to control and rule the world.
Mm.
And I'm sorry, to see that happening, you have to sacrifice something on their altar, and that something is freedom of expression, freedom of individualism, freedom of the human being to find him or herself, period, regardless of your race, your creed, your nationality. Something has to be sacrificed, and that is what is to be sacrificed. Individualism, freedom. I had to make a choice, you see.
And by the way, do you recall anyone else who was with you at the time? Do you recall any other folks who today might be more known, if I put it that way?
I do not. I do not. This was back in the 80s, the early 80s, and I didn't keep notes of the people who were there with me. But I know of some of the main firm they were affiliated with, of course, was Goldman Sachs. We went into Goldman Sachs there in Brooklyn and had a lot of our training there in Goldman Sachs, and they were associates of Goldman's.
Yeah, well, no big surprise there. And if we for a moment talk about Mormonism, the LDS Church, Romney almost got in. I've heard from some people who critique Mormonism that it's referred to as a kind of a pseudo-Masonic cult, almost like you said as well. But would you say that's true, that there's a lot of Masonic things lent into Mormonism?
Well, yeah, that's part of my whole study. And, you know, before I made the conscience decision to exit Mormonism, I had to make sure I was right. I like what Abraham Lincoln said, make sure you're right, then press forward. You got to make sure you're right first. You know, this is a life-changing decision, and it's not an easy one. So, it was 5-6 years of constant research and study. What I uncovered is simply the truth to me, to my soul, to my heart, which is all that matters to me personally, right?
Yeah.
I found and uncovered that really Mormonism from its very inception is an appendage of what is best called Zionism. Zionism is a political movement. It's not a religion. It's a political movement by certain Ashkenazim Jews who are masquerading as God's chosen people.
Now,
you see.
I know what you're referring to when you say that, but explain that for some of our listeners that might not be familiar with Ashkenazim is.
Well, Ashkenazim is a term. It's 85% of modern Judaism is composed of these Ashkenazim, as opposed to the Sephardim. Sephardim are basically the Semites, the true Semites of Middle Eastern descent. The Ashkenazim are European Khazar tribe members that converted en masse to the religion of Judaism, not the bloodline now. They converted to the religion of Judaism in roughly the 7th century, about 638 AD. They did it for political expediency, not for religion. The King Butar made it a commandment, basically, the kingdom of Khazaria, all subjects had to become converted to Judaism. Now, that's the deep, dark secret that they hate to get out there. I found, boy, when you start talking about that, holy cow, you really get they get upset at you for that. But it's the truth. It's not being anti-Semitical. It's not being hateful. It's just declaring the truth. Even some of the Jewish rabbis and scholars absolutely admit that that's the truth. It's in the Judaic Encyclopedia. It's in their own writings. They just don't want the goy, the Christians, to understand that.
Do you think that there's an internal struggle within the community then of those who are of Sephardic descent and those who are Ashkenazim or Khazarians?
Well, absolutely. If you study and look what's really going on in the state of Israel, the nation state of Israel, the Sephardim are hated. They're ridiculed. They're denigrated. They're definitely third-class citizens there. Because of, again, they call them, it's a racist almost mentality to the Sephardic bloodline, which includes, I got to tell you, people of color. I mean, a lot of Negroes are claim their and show their Sephardim Hebrew descent. And so, yeah, it's definitely racist, powerfully so.
I remember hearing about the Beta Israelites, the Ethiopian Jews for many years, and how deeply suppressed they were.
Absolutely. Many of them were wiped out. I mean, it's talk about genocide. See, and this is, again, a global hoax of, again, for the desire of world domination. The ancestry of the Khazars, by the way, if you follow their anthropology, you see they come from the Hittite nation, which intermarried with the descendants of Esau, the biblical Esau, which sold his birthright for a mess of pottage, and then went on to make an eternal covenant, not with the God of the universe, you know, the true God, but the prince of this world, which is Lucifer, which is Satan. So, I mean, it's very, very much is a spiritual conquest going on here, too.
We did an interesting program here a few days ago about usury and talking a little bit about how this was originally seen upon as a sin from the Roman Catholic Church at the time, and then later this was something that was changed through the ecumenical councils. It was brought in through partially the De Medici family and the Fuggers and everything else. And when you were talking about the conversion here, if you will, of the Khazarians over to Judaism, do you think that it has anything to do with the laws of the money structure at that point, that there was a beneficial aspect to favor usury, possibly?
Well, yeah, that's a really interesting point, Heinrich, and thanks for bringing that up. In fact, if you really, really dig deeply, you find the Hittites, the nation of Edom, what I call Edomites, which is really their best description, versus Israelites. There were Israelites versus the Edomites. The Edomites were centered in a region of the Middle East called the Red Rocks of Petra. Petra was the treasury of Petra. This is the city carved out of the Red Rocks.
It's beautiful. Quite
it's a beautiful spot in the modern-day Jordan, right? But you look at the treasury of Petra, which was the lending center of treasures with usury. This was the usury capital of the ancient world. They lent to all kinds of despots and conquerors so that they can raise armies. Well, Petra's treasury, the pillars, the front facade, the delta triangle, the top, is exactly the mirror image of the United States Treasury Building. It's identical.
Yeah.
Okay. It's not by just coincidence. These are the people that want they use usury as a form of bondage, and it's, you know, the God of the Old Testament and Jesus Christ, the God of the New, absolutely says usury is a crime. It's a mortal sin. In fact, in the law of Moses, it was a capital crime. You were strung up, brought and quartered for usury. Then it's very much a capital crime. Now, why is that? You see, because if you have X number of gold, if you control the gold and precious metals, which this tribe basically does, it's very simple to, in economic terms, if you control the gold, there's not any more gold to pay back the interest, you see. So you become a down indebted, enslaved to a downward spiral, you see. Mm-hmm. You become a virtual slave to indebtedness. And see, that's the Western problem big time problem, whether, you know, whether you're going under a euro or you're part of the Greek islands or part of America. The United States dollar is really a Federal Reserve note payable based on usury. See, that's the problem. That's the huge, huge, huge hoax going on right now.
There's an interesting document. I guess we might as well go there already right away because it fits in. The Red Symphony. We have this interesting story of Christian G. Rakovsky, one of the founders, if you will, of Soviet Bolshevism, who is doing and performing an interview, if you will. And there's this document, the Red Symphony. You sent it to me, Drew, and I've been going through it. It's very interesting. And in this, of course, there is a detail about a plan, if you will, of how to use also these different factions in the world, of how they're fighting each other. This what should we call it? I think it's actually in the documents. It's actually referred to as usury capitalism, and also then on top of that, terrorist communism, I think it is, or something like that, if I remember that correctly. Is that right?
Oh, absolutely. Listeners have got to understand and realize that when you hear the word communism, you got to really understand it is a Jewish invention. I mean, without these atheistic Ashkenazis, there would not be world communism. It is, Karl Mordecai Marx is a Jewish thinker and the whole concept of communism is, the antithesis of what freedom, what we're talking about here. Now, they use different words and terms, of course. Progressive, they like to call them being progressive now, not even so much liberal, but it's still the same thing. It's taking the wealth, really the individuality of human beings, taking from the haves who build and giving it to the have-nots. And the people that do that are the ones that profit from it, that they get rich by it. That's the ultimate reality of it. Now, so the Red Symphony, yeah, they talk about terrorist communism. That's who they are. That is who they are. But they also control the other side of the Hegelian dialectic, which is usury capital. Absolutely, they control both of them. They're both tools of this elite group, this secret society. Call them whatever you want to call them. The Illuminati is one. The Frankfurt School is another, perhaps. But they are all really the same head of the beast. Okay?
And they use these different political ideologies, different tactics, basically, to get people riled up on their side. And as you said, with the dialectical force, these two different properties fighting each other, they're capable, if you will, to propel society forward towards the world that they want to see. This is how they're shaping, molding, creating, if you will, the world, correct?
Absolutely. That's the whole thing of the Red Symphony. It's called so because it's like, there's different individual part. Many times it's compartmentalized. You're reading a script, if you will, a line of music, and you're tuning away on your horn or you're playing your violin or your cello. Whatever you're doing, in that way it's compartmentalized. And you really don't care what the other instrument groups are doing. But outside, looking at it, it's a symphony. It becomes a whole part of compartmentalized individual instruments. And this is what this Rakovsky was explaining in this incredible document. You bet. And they utilize the opposite ends of the pendulum. It's called, Dr. Hegel's, the Hegelian dialectic, brought this out. You control both sides of the pendulum, where the pendulum swings back and forth. You control both left wing, right wing. You control both sides of the equation, and people never really see who's really orchestrating both sides. This is, you mentioned Romney, Mittens Romney. A lot of writers talk about, well, it's like Gordon Gekko in the movie Wall Street versus Saul Alinsky, the person of communism. See, but really, if you look deeply, both sides control both candidates,
mm-hmm.
and it really doesn't matter who wins.
And Saul Alinsky, it's Obama's mentor, of course. That's what you're talking about.
Uh-huh. Absolutely. So, yeah, there's a section of Judaism that controls the Democrat and of course, are the handlers of Barack Obama. He's just a puppet. He's just a puppet. And ditto with the Zionist extremists on the other side of the right-wing group, which are the backers of Mitt Romney. And it's always been that way. Whether it's Richard Nixon or Jimmy Carter or Bill Clinton, look behind the curtains and you see the same people manipulating the sides.
Yep, you're right. And the conspiracy here as well is vast, if you will. It's I think it's for some people too big and too horrendous, if you will, for some people to accept it, to let this into their worldview. For instance, it details how Hitler was used as a puppet in this plan to propel forward, to use all these world conflicts, world wars, etc., to get it to overturn, if you will, certain countries at certain times. And so one question that might arise out of this is, well, wait a minute, why should we, if we look at the Red Symphony document and all that, it's like, why should we believe it true? Why do we... should we accept it as being the truth? It's just another story that someone has leaked out, right, to lie.
Okay. The very definition of insanity is simply doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. You know, we've been, here in America, we got to get some conservative Republicans that really stand for God, country, and patriotism into Congress, and so the Tea Party movement is born. Things go on, and nothing ever changes. Why does it ever? Why does it never change? Why is it always static? The answer is because nobody is pulling the curtains away and showing the Jews that are responsible for it. These Edomites, these Ashkenazim. I don't even want to call them Jews because really they're not Jews. They are usurpers of that title.
Well, that was one of my questions. Is it, before you mentioned Zionism, is it a mistake to connect Judaism with Zionism, do you think?
Oh, absolutely. As we know it today, Judaism really is, again, like I said before, 85-90% Ashkenazim. They have no historical ties to the Middle East. None. Zero. You can't return back to a place you've never been historically. So the movement of Zionism is really a code word for world control and domination, using the Middle East as a power base.
Yeah, I was wondering why the Middle East was so important to you, and also why the conflict there seems to have been. I like to see it as it's been exported to the rest of the world, that the this, for a while anyway, small conflict has been now become a world problem, and I see it is not until really England gets involved in there after World War One and starts carving up the map and dividing it up and granting, if you will, the state of Israel, letting that into existence pretty much. What do you know about that and that specific time when this happens back in 1948, I believe it is?
Well, absolutely, yeah. You go back to the Balfour Declaration. You look at really the absolute machinations, the policies put out, and you find that it's really, again, a monetary controls exerted by the House of Rothschild, the big international banking combine of Rothschild, who sits in the top of the City of London. I mean, this is the power base, the City of London. Also, this controls the Vatican. It's tied without a doubt to the Vatican and their Swiss Guard, right? It also is tied to the other power center, Washington District of Criminals. And this is all really an appendage of what I call the octopus. But the epicenter really is the bloodline. They call themselves the Red Shield, the Rothschild. Originally, their name was Bauer, out of Frankfurt, for heaven's sakes. But they changed their name to the Red Shield, adopted the hexagram, the six-pointed star, as their symbol. That was never the symbol of ancient Israel, never the symbol of ancient Hebrews. It's an occultic, deeply satanic symbol. Okay? So, I mean, that's part of understanding the knowledge, the history. The House of Rothschild out of England, they also controlled the monarchy of France. So even though you see French government, the nation of France and England looking at one side as being enemies, mortal enemies, in fact, the financial banking system that controlled both parties were ruled by the same group of people. Now, this is really important to understand because you can see the whole bare root exposed here, Heinrich.
Mm.
You look at what happened during the French and Indian Wars, so-called, here on the American continent, the French and Indian Wars. You see, the King of England, George Washington, was one of the soldiers of the colonial army under the Redcoats, the British. They fought for years on the borders, really defining the border of the British colonies versus the French interests, okay? What happened at the close of the French and Indian War was, see, that the banking interests of the House of Rothschild had lent money to the French and the English. King George, he was faced with crippling war debt. And that's what led to the tax on tea, the screaming of the colonists in America, taxation without representation is tyranny. But see, King George had to raise monies to pay for the war debt. And so what better way than to exact a tax on the colonists that really are benefiting, you know, from the boundaries and the British presence there, see? That's what led to the American Revolution eventually, and Hessian German soldiers, mercenaries, primarily being deployed under Lord Cornwallis to do the fighting. Now, one of the really big aha moments in all of my research was really studying the Articles of Confederation of America, which really was the basic law of the land. The 13 colonies were under a confederation, but they adopted in the constitutional conventions a constitution and displaced the Articles of Confederation. A constitution is a document which basically is the legal agreement for constitutors. A constitutor, Heinrich, is legally defined in Black's Law Dictionary as a person that substitutes on his head the debts of another. Mm. It's all about paying for the Revolutionary War debt.
Mm.
In fact, Benjamin Franklin, you go back to the Treaty of Versailles, where the cessation of hostilities in the American Revolution, the treaty was signed, the colonies agreed in the Constitutor Treaty of Paris to pay and to make payment back to the king, which is really the agent in this case of the House of Rothschild, to pay for the war debt of the American Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, wow, are we really free when we have to pay for the war debt of a battle? You see?
Mm-hmm. Well,
and so it really is that. War is ultimately somebody at the top is being enriched by war and the debt of people.
And so the question is, as well, on top of that, true, is who is behind the conflict to begin with? Because if a king of any nation doesn't have any war to fight, then the probability that he's going to end up in debt to pay for that war is minimal. So the question is, who is there instigating the conflict to begin with, the fight with the war, so that the king has to go to the banker and lend the money to be able to pay for it, you know?
It's a good, very good point. It's the agents of these banksters that cause they sow seeds of strife, and sow the seeds of conflict ultimately, and that's happening today in the Middle East. No matter where you see conflict, there's always some agent provocateurs out there sowing the seeds. Okay.
Yeah.
And that's just the modus operandi of these people. There's a euphemism. It's very accurate. War is hell. Indeed, it is. But the prophets of war are is the greed of these international banksters. That's the bottom line.
And yet, at the same time, then this is how they, as I've heard it, and as you go through the Red Symphony document as well, this is how they have understood that they need to propel society forward again in their vision of where they want to go with it, if you will. But it's only through revolutionary movements and also then on top of that war where you can enforce great change. Otherwise, things would stand still. People would question every decision that was made along the way. Wait a minute, slow down, take it easy. There's nothing of that in wartime. There's no thinking. It's just defeat your enemy or you'll die. You know what I mean? So it's very clever, very, very clever.
Oh, indeed. And the documentation I uncovered of the American Civil War, I mean, you've got the South being agitated and financed by agents of the French government. You see, again, the manipulation of these banksters of international commerce that really, slavery was an appendage of the real problems being agitated to cause the Civil War. And Tsar Nicholas of Russia, for heaven's sakes, his secret police had uncovered documentation in these royal courts of bankers, which he delivered to Secretary of State Seward under Abraham Lincoln. And Lincoln became appraised of really who was manipulating and breaking apart this country. I mean, this is what should be documented in a movie like Lincoln, the movie, right?
Yeah.
But Spielberg, the Ashkenazim, is not going to talk about that. No, there were emissaries sent under Seward and Lincoln to the Southern President Jefferson Davis and explaining all this and say, let's patch up our war. Let's not keep tearing this nation apart. 750,000 white Christian brothers were slaughtered in that Civil War. Who benefits from that? See?
Yeah. How do you tie in? We talked about it earlier a little bit, the British as well, but I've heard about the movements like the British Israelites, that there is a covenant, if you will, between the different people that the British have agreed, if you will, to help the Israelites in different reasons. And again, this is something that was emphasized by the fact that it was through Lord Balfour, and he ultimately, as an agent of one of the Rothschilds, Lord Rothschild, that basically said yes to the state of Israel, that's going to be in effect. So do you know anything more about the deeper relationship between the Brits and the Israelites?
Well, again, it's a big payoff. Again, it's for money. It's all based on the power of gold, ultimately, right? the real power of England is the City of London Financial District, which is run by these Ashkenazim, this tribe of money changers, basically. That's the bottom line. And if you strip away the big lie that this bloodline is not true Israel, that changes things dramatically, doesn't it? You see, because there's no reason for them to be established in Israel. Period.
Mm-hmm. So it's built on a lie, do you think? And also on top of that, do you think that even if it was, let's say that it was God's commandment or whatever, even if we look at the Bible or wherever we want to look for the evidence for that, but would that then justify still their behavior, if you will, of what has happened consequently?
Oh, no. You know, it's just, again, it goes into really what their agenda is long term. And if it's one of world control domination, to cut back the useless eaters, to cut back the goy to 500 million deserving souls to save the planet, which is their agenda, then it all starts to make sense. It's not so much a deep, dark, hidden conspiracy, Heinrich. It's very much an agenda that's right there in front of your face.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But very few have the eyes to see it, though, and the ears to hear it. Why is that, do you think?
Well, they've been hypnotized. One thing, the invention of the television, the what I call the boob tube, the idiot box. They don't call it TV programming for nothing. Okay, and look at the history of television, the waves in which it operates, the flickering screen. It absolutely does put your mind, your brain into an altered state of consciousness. There's no doubt whatsoever about that. Okay? You take a video camera and take a picture of a television screen and play it back. You can see on the video, you see the flashing screen. It affects your frontal lobes of your brain. It alters your conscious level. And people are just flat out modern day under a mass hypnosis. I got to tell you, that's just my own research on that topic. And there's without a doubt. You can prove that by just watching an EKG machine, an EEG, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
People's brain waves are flat out altered after 5 minutes of television viewing.
Yeah, well, it's right. That's why I've thrown out the TV, or I only watch the selected things that I can through the internet and whatnot these days. So, but still, on top of that, though, there's so many other things as well. True, that has to do with why people are, denying, if you will, what's in front of their eyes. It has to do with everything from what they put into their bodies with food and substances, and it seems to be a willing escape, if you know what I mean. It seems to be that many people don't want to face the truth because it's just too vast. It's too horrible. I think they know on maybe some even subconscious level that they make the choice to actively stay away from it instead, you know?
Well, they do, and it's a lot, and it brings up a good point. It's fear-based. People are afraid of losing something. Maybe losing their job, their standard of living, losing something. So they are operating out of fear. And I understand that. But I respond with, fear to me is an acronym, F-E-A-R, false expectations appearing real, F-E-A-R. And that's really when you really start to realize, what was I ever afraid of? It wasn't so bad. There should be no fear in uncovering truth and standing for truth. You see, fear is on a spiritual level, is a very real weapon of the demonic unseen horde. They utilize fear very much so. It's, if you're truly spiritually in touch with creation, if you're spiritually connected to Jesus Christ, like I say, there is no room for fear, because you really do have him as your guide. I mean, that's, I don't know if you want to go there or not, but really, I think it's an important part of this equation. People have lost spirituality, and I'm not talking about religion now. Spirituality is empowering to the human soul, and religion is more often than not divisive, divides that away. Okay, so we lose our spiritual connection to source, and we're fear-based, and we're driven to all manner of deceptions and hoaxes becoming real. All right,
yeah.
So that's kind of the basic philosophy of life as coming from True Ought. You can take it as you leave it, but that's my life experience.
Well, I definitely think you're right in terms of that there is a lack of a greater connection, if you will, to creation, that there is a purpose behind things, that there is, something more than what we just see in front of our eyes. That's where I definitely agree with this. And also, what's interesting with that is that we've seen different movements throughout history that have been destined to kind of sever that connection, if you will, that I think it's kind of a natural connection that most people have. It is with scientism, and it's all just an accident. Nothing means anything. And if you will, then, quote unquote, a godless society has been, I mean, and one of these agents of that has been the Frankfurt School, has been really prominent in that. Why don't we talk a little bit about that, Drew?
Well, absolutely. Yeah, there's a movement. Again, it's gaining traction. It started with Darwinism, the big lie that is evolution And really, because there's, we can talk about that for hours, but yes, and part and parcel to that of the Frankfurt School, so-called, is this outgrowth of what's today called transhumanism, the transhumanism movement, which basically, in a nutshell, is declaring that technology answers all questions of spirituality. You know, I've been a vocal proponent of exposing the dangers of transhumanism, the concept that, well, we can make machines that can answer and solve all of our problems, including the problem of human degeneration, of aging, of disease and death. See, that's where we're heading as a world society governed by these godless atheists that have lost, really have no spirituality. Literally, they want the world to be controlled by a master machine, a beast. And it's heading there rapidly, Heinrich. It truly is.
It's not interesting how if it wasn't true with a beast, as you say, this is a representative of something, of course, but what I've noticed is that it seems to be that mankind collectively is kind of building, they're building their prophecies, you know what I mean? They're building the things that are both that they fear, but I mean, again, just take a look at any movie that shows machines or artificial intelligences, Terminator technology, everything, it's taking over and it's about the destruction of mankind. And it's almost like collectively that we're slowly, step by step, kind of fulfilling that prophecy. Although the promises of transhumanism is that it will be a utopia once we get there. It will be, everyone will live forever and it will be equality and fairness for all. And I think that's one of the biggest lies that they're selling, that movement.
Well, it goes back to the ancient times of the Old Testament. It's nothing new under the sun. I mean, it was a problem during the days of Babylon. It's a problem during the days of Isaiah the prophet. He said in the book of Isaiah, he wrote, "Can the clay on the potter's wheel be greater than the potter himself? Can the clay rise up to usurp the person that made it?" And see, that's the very definition of transhumanism. You know, if humans are just evolved from the great apes, if we're really, you know, just a growth, an outgrowth, you see, of evolutionary technology, then that's a natural logical conclusion. But no, somewhere, you know, there is without a doubt intelligent design in our DNA structure, our firmament of our cells. But you know, as a PhD in nutrition, studying biology and photons of light and photon biology, there was absolutely no way this is by accident that the incredible complexity of our individual cells on a microscopic level just happened by evolution out of pond scum. Absolutely no way. You know, it's ridiculous. You couldn't say that this computer that's sitting on your desk or your laptop could ever have just evolved by itself. But no, it took engineering, it took design, it took construction. And yet the cell of the mitochondria structure, the DNA, the incredible complex, more complex than the laptop computer, you see. And it's just, there's a watermark, an absolute numerical quatrain number watermark of the individual cell that's identical to the numerical text, the complexity yet simplicity of a code in the Bible, both Old and New Testament, Heinrich. It's the same watermark. It's the same mark of the Creator. It's flat-out phenomenal.
If we look at transhumanism as a topic, and if we zoom forward, as you say it, you can go forward as long as you like, and what do you think that mankind will be turned into if this thing is continue to run without any kind of resistance, if you will? Where is this going?
Well, if you haven't yet had a chance to study the subject, I suggest you do so. Transhumanism is going to be the ultimate divisive topic in the next 15 years. It should be right now. It really should be. Probably the biggest voice of transhumanism is the voice of Raymond Kurzweil. Again, another Edomite, Ashkenazim, absolutely atheistic. When, you know, there was a movie put out, you could watch it one time on the internet for free. It's called The Transcendent Man. And it documents the movement, really headed by Kurzweil and other brilliant scientists. I mean, you gotta give him credit. I mean, he's brought the world some amazing technology. And to that, I give him credit. But you can't have it be so dominating that it controls all aspects of society. He declares in the movie Transcended Man, Raymond Kurzweil declares that he sees within the next 2 to 3 decades having all segments of society, all of it controlled by a master computer system, a computer structure, that, like you said, Heinrich, there'll be no more death, there's no destruction. There will be even the ability to resurrect people by means of, they just have to take their genetics, get a DNA sample, and they can, in the lab, resurrect an individual. Now, the question becomes, in this incredible new world, Mr. Kurzweil, who decides who lives eternally and who is relegated and wiped off the pages of history? You say, who decides? Well, the chosen ones do, the select scientific crowd. It goes back to, again, the genetic insanity of Adolf Hitler and the Nazis, the genetic superiority complex. You see, becomes, who is the useless eaters? Which part of the goyim, you have this 98% that's not Jewish of the world's population, who has to be eliminated, you see? That's the question that these transhumanists very expertly avoid. They always say, well, you're a racist, you're they bring the race card in, the anti-Semitic race card, when you broach this.
Yeah, let me ask you a little bit about that and how detailed you see then, from your perspective, Drew, that this plan, if you will, is, because we've had persecution of the Jews, right, in all these European countries, with kind of culmination, if you will, during the Second World War and the Nazis and the exterminations, and of course you can talk about any of these points as you will. But how do you then explain, let's say, to someone who doesn't see this, what you're talking about, that it's been turned into something that now is where this is turned on its head? That's what I'm trying to say. It's 180 degrees right now. First it was like that they're being exterminated, and now it's the opposite, you say. So how, explain that to somebody who doesn't get that, if you can.
Well, that's an interesting thing. I've been come to realize that they use that card, play that card in the deck for their benefit, and they're really projecting what they themselves have done. And let me explain why. First of all, we talked in the first segment about the wars of extermination. You look behind the curtains of the manipulators of these wars, and you see this tribe of people that do the manipulations. Okay, what about Adolf Hitler and these concentration camps? Well, I just got to tell you, again, growing up Mormon, growing up LDS, the LDS Mormon people have a strong affinity with Jews because of they both have a persecution complex. They've both been hated. They've been mobbed, run out of community after community after community, you know, from Ohio, Kirtland, to Nauvoo, Illinois, to Salt Lake, the home of their Zion, right? So they have an absolute affinity with the Jewish persecution complex. But let me tell you, the Mormons got what they deserved. I got to tell you, as an ex-Mormon, objectively, honestly, they brought the problems on themselves. I mean, in a major way. First of all, you know, we can, I don't know how far you want to go down this road, but you know, working as a devout Mormon during my early 20s, I was very involved in the Mormon temple work. Mormon temples are there. They want to basically do temple work for everybody that's lived on the earth and died. They want to save people that are dead, save the dead. I mean, that's really what Mormon temples do, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so to do that, you have to get lists of quantified, validated names of people that really lived, right? This is what the Mormons call the extraction of names. They call it extraction process. So they're constantly employing people to go into places in Europe, places across the planet, really, to do anthropological, historical extraction of names. Now, wow, you have an affinity to the Jewish people. What's a great treasure trove of names? Well, 6 million in the Holocaust, right? You think? Now, again, I'm talking now as a. When I was doing this work, I was an extremely sympathetic, believing, you know, in the hoax Mormon. Believed that the Jews were massacred, were this and that. So, I'm telling you, I was on the outskirts and fringes of this research. It wasn't my project, but I was a helper, you know, with it. And here's the problem. Contacting the International Red Cross, the, you know, going in and researching the German records and other records of Eastern Europe to try and extrapolate the names. I'm sorry to tell you, the best they could come up with about 140,000 names. Far cry from 6 million. Now, wow. Got to keep a lid on that information, don't you? And so you have the World Congress of Organized Judaism screaming bloody murder that you can't have Mormons baptizing Jews in the temples. And so the Mormon hierarchy and to placate the Jews, you know, said we'll never allow any more temple work to be done for the Jews. But wait a minute, they're not saying that there's no 6 million names. Now, to say that in parts of Europe, you're going to be sent directly to jail because you're denying the Holocaust. But it's just a fact. Show me the names. show me the birth certificates. You know, so that leads us to another factor. What about these gas chambers? What about these horrible, you know, the Auschwitz, all these terrible liquidation centers? And I don't need to talk about this, but honest Jews themselves have come forward with documented research and videos that it just didn't happen. Just flat out didn't happen. Now, that's shocking because people, again, in America, because of the concentrated and total continual propaganda, do you have anybody hear those words? It's automatically, well, this guy's some kind of a neo-Nazi collaborator, you know. But I'm just telling you, I'm just saying what I've experienced myself.
Sure. Well, so, we're listening to you, as you said, from your perspective. That's what we like to do here. We invite different people to talk about their work, their research, what they found out, and I understand as well. At the same time, this will be default problematic for many people. It's many people who are Jewish, obviously, will be upset and angry at you for this. You know, that's just.
Well, you know, Heinrich, let's put it in perspective. Man, 140,000 people liquidated or killed. That's tragic. I don't care how you slice it. It's wrong. Okay? The whole thing, the whole tragedy of World War II is flat out wrong. Okay? But see, nobody in the media, which is controlled by this group of people, see, nobody's talking about the firebombing of Dresden, where 500,000 white Christians were incinerated. This was a hospital city, a city of refuge, a city of peace. There was no armaments. This was a bombing that didn't need to happen, but was orchestrated and terrible tragedy. That's, to me, is a real Holocaust. Holocaust is death in fiery flames. Well, tell that to, you know, see the pictures of Dresden, Germany. How about the 45 million white Christians massacred by the Bolshevik policies of the Soviet Union and Russia?
Yeah, yeah.
Nobody's talking about 45 million. What about the Armenian people?
Yeah.
The Christians of Armenia, they were systematically slaughtered by the millions. See?
What you're saying here is that there is a very an unbalanced historical review going on. That's what you're saying. And
absolutely.
Also the other side, that there is not much mentioning of the others. You're talking about how the Holocaust has been used, if you will, for historical purposes or for how to... you use it in such a way so that you can steer history in a certain direction. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. And you go back into looking at the history of the movement, the Jews of Eastern Europe, these Ashkenazim, they were put into what's called the Pale of Settlement. Those who are living outside the Pale were, you know, they were active. They wanted to promote the Zionistic, the Zionism in their prayer books. They want to promote a Zionism movement. Now, largely the resident Ashkenazim Jews of Poland, Hungary, modern-day Czechoslovakia. In 1819, there was a mass Jewish conference held in Germany, in Hamburg, Germany. And I've reviewed this mass conference. It stretched over days, okay? The whole debate topic basically was that of Zionism. Now, they took a vote. They were democratic in their process. The rabbis and representatives of modern-day Judaism, they voted, and the Zionism concept was dramatically voted down. They voted to take it out of their prayer books. They would no longer have returning to Israel as their goal, because they all knew they weren't from that region. They knew that their roots go back right there in that Pale of Settlement region. And they just wanted to live in peace. They had no hegemony concepts. They wanted just to live their lives in peace. It was voted down. Now you get the exodus at that point in time of the strongly rabid extremist Zionists within this tribe of Judah, as they call themselves. They went to places west. They settled up in England, the United Kingdom. The majority of them left for America, and they became settled in New York City primarily. This is the basic core, and these were wealthy, quite wealthy Jews that controlled a lot of money, a lot of bank accounts. Okay, now you look at the bloodlines. What I found was interesting. The names of the hundred or so thousand that were extracted. You look at them closely, and they are the leadership, the relatives of the leaders of the most rabid anti-Zionists in Europe. Isn't that just interesting?
Hmm. Now.
Just interesting.
Now, in a little while here, Drew, we're going to take a little break and continue to talk more. Let's talk about two more points, and then we can take a little break. I want to hear what your website is and stuff like that as well. But in your view, is it a mistake to generalize that, you know, all who are Jewish are, if you will, quote unquote, in on this? Sometimes use the term Jewish, then Ashkenazim and Zionist. And is there distinction that should be made here, do you think?
Oh, absolutely. And there's a... I'm glad you brought that out, because I say this in my radio show all the time. That's why I don't like to use the term Jew, because there are, I would say the vast majority of Jewish people are good people, are great people, good Americans, good Swiss people, whatever. It's not the name itself that should distinguish them. It really isn't. It's sadly the segments, the Zionist segment, its political movement, the communist segment, that we need to focus on, not casting aspersions on all people of that race, because they're not all. I don't think they're all involved. Just like not all Mormons are involved in what's going on in Mormonism.
Yeah, I've heard from some researchers also that says that the Jewish people have been used by families like the Rothschilds. They use the Jewish people like a shield, almost, if you will, to protect themselves behind and to advance their agenda with the aid of the Jewish people. What do you think about that?
I think it's a very accurate statement, indeed. They use people, no matter what it is, no matter who they are, they use people because, again, they are godless. They're atheistic transhumans.
All right. Well, why don't we take a little break here at this point, Drew, and we'll continue to talk more in the next segment. But I do want to hear what your website is, where people can go to find more of your material. You mentioned you had the radio show. If people want to tune in and listen more, where do they go to do this?
Well, I broadcast on the Micro Effect radio network. That's the Micro Effect. And it's got a good little network. They have micro broadcasters across the world that pick it up on KU Band Radio. Also, my blog is just www.atrue.com.
All right. Well, we'll have the links up on our website, and you can check it out there if you want to read and find out more. But we'll take a short break here. To stay with us. We'll continue with more in a little bit. Be right back. As we continue in the second hour for members, True shares biblical scripture and explains how he sees that the model of Christ brings balance. He'll tell us about Gaddafi's Green Book and his philosophies that presents a different version of who he was. At the end of the hour, True talks about nutrition, grain toxicity, agribusiness, and the agenda to destroy us. You can sign up for a subscription at redeyesmembers.com when you want to hear more. We have up towards 700 programs on fascinating and eye-opening topics. We keep a diverse range of guests with different perspectives, and I'm sure that you will find many of our programs interesting with lots to learn from. And upcoming on the program, we have Lynn Picknett on Lucifer Revised. We have Tom Horn on the abdication of the Pope and Vatican disclosure. We also have Richard Hoagland on torsion field measurements at Chichen Itza. We'll discuss his arrest by Mexican police while taking measurements there on the 21st of December 2012. But we'll continue right now with True Ought in the second hour. Thank you for listening.